Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe.
Is this the part where I say I'm Ryan?
Well, it would be if you were Ryan. This is the part where we have an announcement to make. On behalf of Ryan, he gave me a message to send to you all. He says to say that he's going to be taking some personal time away from the show. And don't worry, you will still see him pop up on occasion. But for the time being, this will just be a close-up with Joe and whatever guest stars I can wrangle up. To be frank, this is all happening pretty recently, so honestly don't have much in place for the future, but Justin was kind enough to come in today on short notice and sub in for a review for Hold Your Breath, a film which we caught at the tail end of the Toronto International Film Festival the other week, and we're going to be talking about that today. So let's get into our medium shot and give him a warm welcome. So, Justin, what was your anticipation like going into this film, or just TIFF in general, because neither of us had ever been before? Brand new experience.
Well, I was going in expecting it to be fairly busy. You know, it's TIFF. It's like the biggest film festival in basically Canada. Well, definitely Toronto. And the film we went to see, I didn't really know much about it. It was kind of, we went to the last minute before we got tickets, and then, you know, the synopsis looked interesting. All I really knew was that it was a period piece and set in
1930s Dust Bowl, Oklahoma.
Yeah, and it was a thriller slash horror.
Yeah, a mutual friend of ours this year said, hey, let's go to TIFF. And somehow, having never been, despite going through the Cinema and Media Studies program, York University, I was down in Toronto a lot. I was surrounded by people who were super into film. It was always the talk of the department every September. Somehow never made the time to go. So when this friend said, hey, Joe, Justin, come on down with us. Go to TIFF. I said, well, shouldn't pass up this opportunity. If I'm going to have any credibility as a film reviewer, we should go to, you know, the biggest festival in Canada, like Justin said. Even if we just catch this film that I'd never heard of, I'm not really familiar with the work of most of the people who worked on this. I had very few expectations going in, if any, although I was intrigued by the premise. 1930s Dust Bowl, Oklahoma. All right, I haven't seen a film in that setting since, well, it's been a long time, so could be something interesting. Who's to say? Let's give it a shot, see what happens. So, let's get into the review then. Let's get into our close-up and just rip the Band-Aid off and talk about this thing. It was pretty good, I'd say. Not exceptional by any stretch, but having had no expectations for it, I was pleasantly surprised by the film we got.
Yeah, it was intense. And yeah, there were some elements of it that were really interesting. My overall opinion was that it was, you know, it was pretty good.
Which we both say with a little bit of hesitance, I guess, in retrospect. I think we came out of the movie not necessarily high on it, but it was better walking out of the theater than it is thinking about it a week later.
That, yeah, I mean, for the, sure. The more I think about it, the more I feel like you can poke some holes or there's some stuff still left dangling that it's like, oh, okay. And yeah, when we walked out initially, it's like, oh, yeah, it was really good. You know, you're caught up in the whole thing, but
it's the vibe of TIFF.
Once you really think about it, yeah,
it's the wow.
You think about the story and all the stuff, and it's just it starts falling apart a little bit, I find.
Yeah. And now is probably when I should warn you that this is a full spoiler discussion. Sorry to you, because the film isn't out yet. It's not coming out till, I believe, October 3rd. So we're getting this out a little in advance. But heck, a lot of you probably aren't going to be watching this episode till after that anyway. So you'll probably be fine. And maybe you won't even see this one. Somehow I doubt most of you will. It's probably, this is the kind of movie that doesn't do big numbers at box offices. It gets whatever acclaim it gets at the grand film festival it premiered at, and then it quietly slinks away in the theatrical run somewhere. Maybe gets a cult following on streaming if it's lucky. It's just that kind of film. I don't see this doing big numbers, especially when compared to whatever other horror thrillers we're supposed to be getting within the next month during Halloween spooky season. I don't think it's going to measure up to those in terms of what a horror audience is looking for. So,
what I think most people will get out of it, like, it'll be remembered for the acting. It'll be performances from the actors, like the guy from The Bear was excellent, and the main actress is very well known in modern horror. So,
yeah, Sarah Paulson is the lead actor in this film. I've never seen American Horror Story, but they sort of hyped it up before they showed us the film. Oh yeah, it's from Sarah Paulson, who does American Horror Story, and everyone in the audience is like, ooh, we're so excited to see this because of her, basically. And I'm like, I've got no expectations about this woman, but all right. If everyone in the theater is kind of a buzz about her, I should hope that means something. I think the only cast member with whom I was familiar was Eben Moss-Bacharach, who plays Richie in The Bear, which Justin and I both watch and thoroughly enjoy, especially his role. I'm not like this because I'm in Van Halen. I'm in Van Halen because I'm like this. We quote that a lot. He's just exceptional on that. And I love to see him do such a vastly different role from Richie. He's such a great comedic performer in that, although you do see get his dramatic chops come out a lot on that show as well. He blends drama and comedy very effectively on The Bear. Here, he's just straight up intimidating, and he's really the horrific element for a lot of the act two of this film, until he starts taking a back seat, and then it's kind of just the memory of him that lingers as the intimidating factor.
Well, he starts as intimidating, but because of the way he did his performance and everything, and the way they set everything up, you know, even the audience lets their guard down too with him, because he's this preacher guy, and when the family comes to trust him, the audience kind of trusts him too. So,
yes, it's your husband's jacket. He gave it to me, and he sent me here to make sure you were all well. I'm a preacher. I'm a healer. Oh, your daughter's got, I don't remember if it was nosebleeds or migraines, or you got a big problem. Okay, I'll, you know, just trust me for 2 seconds. I'll heal her. And even with your backup about this guy thinking, oh, he's probably some kind of fraud, he did heal the daughter. For all intents and purposes, she didn't fall ill for the rest of the movie. And he
Which was never explained again.
Or the scene where he brought down rain for the first time in months, or at least so it appeared, as he's standing out in the rain, and the implication is he was the one that brought this. He is some sort of mystic personality, which the film never tries to explain away, oh, he was really doing these things, or 100% he was a fraud. It's sort of implied he was some sort of mystical preacher, con man figure. And I thought it was, I did like that the supernatural was just sort of left up to interpretation. Did that really happen, or was it just coincidence? It was just an intriguing element of the movie for its subtlety. And I liked the idea of a desperate preacher like this, where he's just, you know, a man of the cloth probably gets into the church because they want to perform some good or preach the word of God to their followers. And he was a natural born healer, like he said. But then you take this, man of faith and you twist him into something perverted and evil. He's basically just known as a drifter in the Oklahoma Dust Bowl. He takes advantage of anyone he comes across. Yeah, sometimes he does actually heal them, but he's really a man out for himself in the end, who uses his powers and the visage of the church to gain people's trust wherever he goes. But the funny thing is, once again, sometimes he does actually help people while he's taking advantage of them. So it's a very complex character all around.
Yeah, he plays a bit of both worlds when you go into it. Like, once he's kind of using that preacher as his cover, but also you think, like, that is what he believes in. That's what he's pushing. But he's also got this side of him that's darker, right?
Yes.
And he could almost keep it away if nobody would find out. It's almost like he's running from his past a little bit.
Yes.
But still not, you know, once people figure him out, they're like, oh, yeah, this guy's no good. And he just wants to be seen as good, I guess.
I don't really believe he cared what people thought of him so far as until he gets what he wants from them. I'm here for some food, some clothing, and shelter. Because, you know, it's not like he was knocking down their door. He was hiding in their barn till they found him. And it was only after they found him he starts, oh, well, you know, your husband sent me, and if I just knocked on your door, I knew you'd be afraid. And he starts spinning this story and trying to gain their trust only after he's busted in the barn. He was perfectly willing to just...
Yeah, once he gets caught.
Yeah, that's... He was perfectly all right to not be seen if he didn't get caught. I did enjoy that they set up this drifter earlier on in the movie. What was that one story that the ladies at church were telling? It was something along the lines of, oh, yeah, so there was this guy and he was killed and... People are like, they kill him. This drifter killed him and his son and disappeared. And that's what the story is. And everyone's scared about the drifter. And then later on, they're like, oh, well, maybe it wasn't a drifter after all. Maybe it was the guy killed the son and then killed himself, maybe. And that's about the point in the movie where Sarah Paulson's character is starting to trust the preacher. And, oh, well, you know, hearing this story makes me think, okay, well, maybe there's no drifter around after all. Maybe this guy was the drifter and I had those suspicions up, but now my guard's a little bit down. Hearing, well, maybe that story wasn't totally true in the first place. And that so lets...
Going back to the barn with him hiding in there, there's another hole that was poked is he was the one letting out the horse at night or the animals, right?
Yeah.
So why would he be doing that if he was trying to hide?
Right. Well,
I think that was one of my biggest things my biggest complaint with the film is that there's a lot of spots where you can poke holes in it. It's like it's the concept is really cool. The execution is done really well, but it feels like it needed some more, you know, script work to it.
A little, one more pass just to, let's see, I'm going to take a stab in the dark there. Just, mind you, my memory on this film is a little bit hazy. I saw it a couple weeks ago, and I can't refresh myself with the details too thoroughly online, because there's not a whole lot out about it right now. But from what I recall, There was a window to the top floor of the barn. Maybe you could say he wasn't a good climber. Maybe you could say he just opened the door and the animal got out or something. And didn't try to close it back up. Because the next morning, the mom found it and was like, why didn't you close the door? That was your one job. She's like, what? I did do it. And there was only one instance of that, if I recall. So that was probably the one time he did sneak in. And maybe he just never left after that. Maybe he was surviving on the hay or something. He did show them that trick to extend the life of the hay. By sticking the hay in water, so maybe he was living off the cow too, just staying in the barn. Or maybe it's a plot hole. That's also very possible. Who's to say? But, yeah, in general terms of the writing, I think the script of the page is just fine. It's not exceptional. If anything, it's a tad exposition-y and sometimes kind of spells out the foreshadowing a little too much. But in terms of story and plot, I thought it was pretty great. I quite enjoyed the characters, although I feel like that was more down to the actors than what's on the page necessarily. They brought out a lot of subtextual elements, which I don't know were on the page. But I did enjoy this story set in 1930s Oklahoma, Dust Bowl. It's a desolate place where there's very few people around, and the community is pretty important to each other because they're sort of all they have. And these dust storms are just a constant threat, where the very air around you can choke you to death in the night. And there's really no escaping it. If you want to, you can abandon your community and go out for work, like, you know, a lot of the men did. They went out to Philadelphia to build the bridges or whatever. But these people want to stay for their children and hoping that their land and their homes could be redeemed by rain someday. All this can't be forever, right? This Dust Bowl thing, this is just a blip in the community. We can't all abandon it. And just the general paranoia that builds up when you're stuck in this place, trying to hope beyond hope that things will change, and then they just keep getting worse and more desperate. It's a great setup, which I thought was carried through pretty well for the most part, despite the second act dragging a little in pacing. I especially love the slow descent into paranoia and obsession and angst of the mother character as she, at the beginning, she's more trying to protect her children's health. It's more, okay, well, you know, we can plug up the holes of our home with whatever I can just so the dust doesn't get in at night. I'll sweep the floors, try to keep the place clean. But then as the film goes, it becomes more and more obsessive. Oh, we're going to use every spare piece of linen we have. We're going to plug every single hole. I see even a speck of dust flying in the air. I nearly freak out because, oh, it's going to kill my kids. Just, she sort of, she bangs out their sheets every single night, hangs them up, washes compulsively. Just her entire life becomes about keeping the dust out of her house to the point where it drives her crazy. Even outside, you know, she goes to her cousin's house. Place is full of dust. She doesn't keep care of it. Nobody else takes care of their stuff. So we got to stay home where it's safe. You leave the house for 2 seconds, there's dust storms blowing across the land, so thick you can't even see through. We got to run back home, barricade ourselves in just to avoid this dust. Her cousin's kid died from the dust. They tried to ride out in the storms, choked to death. And she sees all these things and starts isolating herself at home because it's an environment she can control. until she can't. Because then this drifter comes and starts coming into her home and mingling with her family. And she starts hearing that story that her daughters tell of the mythical gray man who lives in the dust. And if you breathe him in, he becomes part of you and he's evil and all this stuff. And she starts conflating the two. Also, she has a lot of trouble sleeping. So all this paranoia and obsession and this dangerous man who comes into her home and ultimately ends up threatening her children. All these things just start slowly driving her to madness. And I feel like that's all set up and paid off pretty nicely.
Well, I think another point there, you're speaking about her lack of control. Not only is it when the man comes in, but despite doing everything she can, even plugging every single hole and isolating them to the one room, the dust still gets in. She still doesn't have control over her space. She's made their, slowly throughout the movie, she makes their space smaller and smaller. Like, it starts in their, they're going to their cousins, or then they start staying more around the house. Then it's stay inside the house, inside the room. So
she even moves her bed into her kids' room in the end, just so they're all confined into one room at night. Even though she knows, actually, that was a very interesting element to it, because they sort of set up earlier on in the movie, the mom's got night terrors, and is kind of a danger to the kids herself when she's asleep. And they don't hammer it into you when the mom moves her bed into the kids' room. But there is sort of a point that's addressed of like, okay, well, like, should you be in here with us? Oh, well, you know, I'm trying to keep you safe. Okay, but like, you're kind of the danger. And that's where it started getting very interesting, because at the start, the dangers were all outside, and it was the drifter, it was the dust. She's so afraid of these dangers getting into her house that she ultimately ends up becoming the danger from within. She's the one who ends up threatening to kill her kids and nearly succeeding more than anybody.
And that's probably one of the coolest moments in the whole film is where we see from her perspective. Can we talk about that yet? Coming to the end, right? So we see from her perspective what her terrified brain is seeing, and she's got the gun pointed at who, you know, the gray man, the drifter, and he's approaching her and trying to plead with her in this mocking tone. He's like, "It's me, Mom." But as she continues closing in, you can hear the daughter's voice in the background, in behind, which I think that was an excellent performance by, what's his name? That was
Evan Ross Bockert.
Phenomenal. Yeah, because
there was a lot to that. It was editing, it was sound design, it was the storytelling. There was a lot that combined to make that moment so effective, because the editing shows us that the mom is outside with the shotgun. Okay, she sees scary things. She's upset. We also see the daughter going out to talk to her, even though the mother specifically told her to stay inside, but whatever. So that we know the daughter is actually out there. But also the editing tells us she's seeing the gray man, Eben Moss Bockerick, right in front of her. She's got the gun pointed at his face, and because she's so paranoid and he's already hurt their family, you're pretty convinced she might just shoot the guy, even though we know it's the daughter. So we see both perspectives.
She did try to shoot him earlier, right?
Yeah.
When she shot her cousin.
I think that was later.
So we know that she's pulled the trigger before on this man. Yeah, because she saw him early. Yeah, she killed. That was the first kill she did cousin when. Yeah, so she's already shot this guy. And
which we didn't realize till later. We didn't realize who she actually shot till the sheriff came and found the body. Because before it was like, oh, she just shot the gray man. But we only saw it from her perspective that time. We were pretty sure it wasn't the Gray Man, but we also never knew what she shot. Just something that was moving. But yeah, so the editing is bringing them together. So just visually, it's a very interesting scene. The mom seeing this drifter, the daughter's pleading with her mother not to shoot her. And then the sound design, that's the best moment of sound design in the movie, when the daughter's voice and the drifter's voice are overlapping in different tones. One's mocking, the other's pleading. You hear both perspectives from the mother's mindset. She doesn't really know what to believe. That was an exceptionally crafted scene. Very tense. You didn't know how it was going to resolve itself. That's just all elements of film working very well for that one moment specifically.
Yeah, I was pretty convinced at that point. Like, I had no idea if she was going to shoot her or not. I was like, she might shoot her. She might actually do it.
Yes. And I believe that was the part. This was before the mom was being a clear danger to the family, where it was obvious her obsessions were starting to get the better of her, but before she was outright, you know, threatening to murder suicide. Which,
yeah, this was pretty much the first moment where she was really losing it. Basically, after that, it went ridiculously downhill.
In terms of tension building, the other scene I really loved was, I believe it was after all that bit, where the daughter really wants to go to a local dance. This is the first time the family has been in the community for a while, because they slowly started isolating. And then the mom takes them to the dance, and she's so paranoid that the daughter's going to tell the sheriff she's an unfit mother, because she pulled that on her cousin earlier when her cousin was having a mental breakdown. She got the kid taken away from her, and the cousin's running down the street screaming, "You're going to be just like me one day." And that's getting in the mom's head, as she knows she's having a bit of a mental breakdown. And if somebody told the sheriff, she'd easily be seen as unfit to take care of her own children. Which, you know, seeing the movie, we're like, well, that's her whole thing, is she's trying to protect her children. So how devastating would it be if she's called unfit now, after all she's already sacrificed and the toll it's already taken on her mental health, to be called unfit now, even though she clearly is?
Well, I think that was one thing I found a little odd even when we first watched it, was when she finally loses it and she spills out her real motivation. Oh, my kids are a part of me and I want us to all stay together. That line, out of context, if they put that earlier in the film, you could blend that in and have that idea put in the background before any of that happened, and it would be a line that's just like, oh, it's a sweet thing, you know, my kids are a part of me, and then had it recontextualized at the end, which I felt like that idea kind of, it was there, but it just felt like it came out of nowhere.
Well, just to clarify for the audience here what you're getting at, so they reveal later on in the film that we already knew they had another daughter who died and was buried on this property. And there was these hints throughout the film of, okay, but why don't we just leave, though? And we never really knew why, except the dad was away sending money over, and this was their home, and why would they leave their home? It'll get better. But then, like Justin's saying, there was that moment later on in the movie where she reveals she doesn't want to leave because her daughter's buried there. She feels her daughters, even in death, are a part of her. There's like a piece of her buried underneath the ground on that plot, and she just can't bear to leave. And because the situation is looking so hopeless, she feels more comfortable killing her remaining daughters and herself so that she doesn't have to see more pieces of herself die, or I guess leave pieces of herself without the whole. She just figures, just end it all pretty well by that point. Which I agree with you. It's that idea could have been set up earlier. Just the fact that she's not leaving because of this daughter, which at the time you might have said, oh, okay, well, that's a little, okay, like, I get it, but bit of a strange thought, I guess, but you're grieving, okay, and then later see how that thought gets corrupted when she starts losing it, basically.
You were speaking of the dance earlier. There was the scene right before that with the sewing needle.
The sewing needle, yeah.
Which got, the audience reaction was pretty loud for that one.
I'd say that was arguably the only scene in the movie that got a very vocal reaction. The dance did as well, or just before the dance when she cuts her own leg open. Just to use blood as like blush. As a blush. But then the needle scene as well, where she's just kind of casually sewing something and then starts sticking the needle through her own hand, just absentmindedly. The worst part, though, was when she pulls up the fabric that she'd sewed her own hand into, and you see the stitches in the skin start pulling up. That, and she's barely reacting to any of it. That was what made everybody, which was very effective effects work. I guess that was prosthetics. It looked practical, but it was an impressive effect used for its casualness. That's what made it so shocking.
Well, it really made her very, like, we knew at that point that she was really unhinged.
Yeah. Definitely.
And it also put it also put into doubt whether we were seeing an unreliable narrator. Like afterwards, when we know she's unhinged, and then we start at the dance, you start kind of like she's almost kind of imagining things at the dance too, right?
Yes. And she hears somebody's coming in with a preacher, and then she sees that preacher, even though it wasn't that guy. It was just another dude.
But yeah, so it kind of calls into the whole film into possibly an unreliable narrator throughout. We actually have no idea because we've been seeing it from her perspective, basically solely from her perspective, almost always.
Which also calls to mind a theory I had after watching the film about the money. Where the daughters were like, oh, well, you know, if we save up enough money, we could, you know, go visit dad in Philadelphia or something like that. And we already knew the dad was sending the money, but the mom kept saying, oh, no, you know, we're too poor for that. We don't have the money. I had some alarm bells going off, though, when she goes to the doctor and, oh, she doesn't have enough money to get out of Dodge, but also she's got enough money to buy all these sleeping pills from the doctor or those filter masks from him as well to protect her children. I'm like, okay, so if you're really that strapped for cash, are those things just dirt cheap? I doubt medication like that's that cheap. I feel like she was hoarding the money and just lying to her daughters because as we realize later, she was never planning to leave that place no matter what.
Well, even during the film, we saw other people with masks. We saw people with makeshift stuff. Like, we saw older style of masks.
Yeah.
They had the nicest masks in the whole film.
New technology. It was in a display case in the medical office. Like, hey, well, you know, this is a new type of mask, which you can afford for some reason. I think she was just lying about her finances. That's my theory. I think she was making okay money that she was just hoarding for her sleeping pills and whatever else she could use.
And I guess the whole time she had that idea in the background that they weren't going to leave specifically because of the dead daughter.
I don't think she was planning a murder-suicide the whole time.
No.
Not until it became pretty oppressively bleak for her. where she, you know, had a public breakdown in front of the entire town, clearly showing she's unfit to raise her children. Even though her kids were very loyal to her, they stood up for her. The eldest daughter was even like, oh, well, no, the drifter's real. She's not making that up. She's, you know, being a little crazy right now, but he was real. You know, she was trying to defend the mother. But after this very public breakdown, she realizes her kids are probably going to get taken away from her, which sort of breaks her master plan of everyone being together in this little farmhouse forever. So by that point, she sort of knew, I gotta go out on my terms, because I'm going to have other people's wills thrust upon me pretty soon. And the danger's not going away, so. Let's see what else. Also, let's go back to some of the effects work. I thought that I'm having trouble thinking of a ton of visual effects in this film that were, well, I'd say especially obvious, but
well,
in hindsight, I like the dust storm. There was a lot of, in that one scene.
Yeah, there was a lot of the storms, and even there were subtle things where they used the light in rooms. They used the lights, and I think it was practical effects, mm-hmm. but just to show that dust coming in everywhere, like that would have been so much work to have the like the dust is there in basically every shot. Like, yes. You can always see it floating in the air, and maybe there was some post-work on that done, too, but they used that to great effect, the dust and everything.
I like in her dreams how the dust is basically choking her alive. Things are nice in the nice green fields, and then the dust storms come in and just overwhelm her. Those were all really well done. I also like the scene when she's going out to investigate the barn at night, and there's just this thick layer of fog just at knee height across the entire farm. That was a beautiful scene. I don't know if that was a practical fog machine on a set or if that was visual effects, but that was a really beautiful looking shot. I want to pivot into costumes and production design too. Speaking of, you know, the dust and the environments, calls to mind other environments in the movie. I love how all the sets looked suitably worn and lived in, and in the case of some of them, just grimy and covered in a couple millimeters of dirt sometimes, just to drive home how dust is everywhere. It was in all the set design, and very organically as well. That was quite well done. I also enjoyed the costume design for this film, because you look at the costumes in this movie and you think, well, you know, those look relatively plain, I suppose, just regular clothes. But personally, that's their strength, is they don't look like period costumes. They just look like old worn clothes that people from this era in this area too might have worn. It was blended pretty nicely. And I always consider that an element of good filmmaking when you don't notice things or you don't call things into question. Sometimes if you look at a costume and say, oh, that's a beautiful costume, they already lost you because you took your mind out of the film to say that's a beautiful costume, not just accept it as an outfit in the movie. I didn't get that in this. It was just outfits people wore that looked pretty period specific. And yeah, so that's compliment to the production designers and costumes. And the makeup as well. The one that impressed me particularly was the makeup on the mother and the boy when they were found after the dust storm, and the boy choked to death on the dust, and it looked like all the life had been sucked out of their faces nearly. There was just dust all over their faces. They looked dirty and beaten down from from the Gales. That was
speaking of that that scene in particular. That beyond the flashes into, you know, what ended up being the end of the film, the jump scares were very limited. Like there was that one that got pretty much everybody in the audience where she's still alive and coughs up the dust. And then, but the only other ones after maybe the first or second time you have a flash, like flash cut to her kind of nightmares, it becomes predictable. And the film didn't rely on jump scares like many horror movies do.
The only one that was sort of a surprising scare was when she stabbed the sheriff at the end. And even that one, I'm like, okay, well, I can predict what's going to happen. I know this sheriff is going to die. I just don't know how. Which is why I appreciate it. Oh, he gets into the room and immediately takes the gun. I'm like, okay. Okay. So that'll make, you know, 90% of the audience feel a little more at ease. Oh, he got the gun. Thank goodness. Wow, she's not going to shoot him. But then there's me in the back of my mind. I'm like, they already showed she had a blade. He didn't take that blade. She still got it somewhere. And what do you know? Right through the gut. Oops. So I but to be fair, I only saw it coming the moment before it happened. It did have me for a second when he took the gun away. I was like, okay, I appreciate you tried to set up, to put people at ease for a second. And I think it would have gotten most people if you didn't remember the knife. Let's see. I like the color palette in this movie. It's the two that stand out to me the most are the fields at night. There's these really nice, harsh, cool tones. Seems just unforgiving and cold and lifeless. And in the daytime, it's this dead brown dirt sort of look, which is especially nice when contrasted with her vibrant dreams in green fields full of sunny blue skies and green wheat and all. So just these contrasting colors between sort of warm, life-affirming colors and these dreary, lifeless environments made the contrast between what this place used to be and what it is now a little bit more clear, just in a visual way. Let's see. What else do we have to say about this? Well, do you have any thoughts on the cinematography or editing? Those are more your areas, if anything.
Well,
I remember you had some complaints about the inside versus outside scenes.
Yeah, the outside scenes were done really well. There was more dynamic camera work. And I think that was a limitation because the building they shot in, it must have been a real building. So when they got inside, they had to be more safe with the shots. And there wasn't as much going on. It wasn't as dynamic. Other than that, I don't know if anything was too... Nothing too special, I don't think. Other than that usage of light creeping it, like creeping through the cracks or showing the dust floating in the air. That was all. It used light interestingly.
I think it's all the more impressive. I mean, I know general audiences don't give a damn about this part of it, but I believe they announced before the film that Carrie Krause and Will Joynes are first-time feature film directors. This is their debut, which when you consider that, sometimes I get some of the flaws of this film a pass for that reason. I don't expect a 10 out of 10 on the first try. We aren't, you know, Tarantino with Reservoir Dogs, most of us. All right. But it's a very solid debut for a feature. And that's why I'm willing to forgive some of the flaws. But I reiterate that I know most people are just looking to see a movie and it's either good or it's not. You don't really care. Oh, well, you know, you don't get a participation trophy. But they made a movie and it was pretty competent. Some of it was even exceptional or just above average or even very well done in some instances. So, you know, they faltered in some respects. But I do think in most elements of film making, they were either about on par with a general quality or above average. So,
yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing was even one of the first things we said when we started walking out of the theater was, you know, when we looked quickly before, you know, we read it was like 93 minutes or something. That was a long 93 minutes.
Yes. But the interesting thing about it was that every individual scene was paced pretty well. I never felt the drag scene by scene. It was only when the movie's taken as a whole you start to feel it. And I think that's by virtue of very limited settings. Most of this movie is either set in the church, on the farmhouse property, in the house, in the barn, and sometimes the cousin's house. There's maybe five locations in this whole movie and a couple of outdoor shots. And most of them revolve around the mom being paranoid about dust. The fact that they managed to keep it as interesting as they did in 93 minutes is very impressive to me. But also, it probably could have had another pass on the script, as you said. Maybe another pass on the edit, too. Because some of the scenes, while I could see why they were kept, they did add some nuggets of information. A more efficient pass or some reshoots probably could have amalgamated some information a little bit more efficiently into other scenes. And just, I think that's what would have helped it, if anything, was just some scenes didn't add enough to be kept in. Like the one I'm thinking of in particular is the next church meeting where they said, oh, well, you know, this time maybe we were wrong. Maybe it wasn't the Drifter. And other stuff was happening in that scene, but that was really the only important piece of information. And just kind of an excuse to go back to the community setting again. Like, just because they felt there wasn't enough of the community in there or without it. Just for example. Just conjecture there. But so I can understand why every scene was there. But it also didn't need to be there. So it's sort of this strange thing.
Yeah.
I get the choices. I just don't necessarily agree with them or how they ended up in the final product.
I mean, making a film is all about, like you've said before, killing your darlings, basically. You have things that you love, you put in the script, but unfortunately not everything can make it. And I feel like that was probably the case with this one, is it just needed tightening it up, and it needed somebody with fresh eyes, maybe a pass on the script to just be like, hey, this scene isn't really accomplishing very much.
Which I can completely understand why that happened, because just from reading the credits here, this was written by Carrie Krause, who was also the co-director. So, you know, writer-director situation. I feel like in a lot of cases, if a director, this is how most of the time it goes, when a director takes a writer's script, they're seeing it with fresher eyes and lesser biases. You can kill somebody else's darlings a little more readily than your own, except the mother in this movie. She didn't give a damn, but I mean, by the end. But yeah, I also want to talk about Amaya Miller, who played the eldest daughter in the movie. I thought we haven't mentioned her thus far, but I think she's sort of the linchpin that holds a lot of this plot together, because we follow the mom's perspective for a very long time, but the daughter is also the most engaging supporting character throughout the movie. And I think it's important that we care about her. Otherwise, the entire third act basically falls flat. Once the mom basically fully loses it, the daughter turns into the protagonist at that point, when she starts being like, oh, well, now the danger's my mom and I don't really know how to deal with that. Do I have to kill my mom now just to protect my little sister? And that was a very good twist at the very end there, because I didn't know she was just going to give up and let the mom kill them. It nearly seemed like she would at a second there until she tricked the mother into wandering out in the storm and cutting the rope. I'm like, oh, okay. So you had me guessing right to the end how the daughter was going to handle this, and even if she would. I was impressed in general with her. And, well, that's most of what I have to say on this movie, I don't think. Well, the other thing I'd like to mention is, I don't know if I would have caught this theme necessarily if the presenter beforehand hadn't mentioned that this was sort of based on COVID. And with that lens in mind, I was watching the movie with that in mind. I'm like, oh, well, okay, now I see it. The dust is a metaphor for airborne illness. You're isolating yourself in your home away from your community. You're extremely paranoid. Oh, am I gonna get infected with it? Like the Gray Man story, you breathe it in, he infects you, it's evil. Is it gonna get my kids? How do I protect my kids? And then, like, unfortunately happened a lot in real life, the danger ended up coming within. You get stuck in your home with people who, I guess to put it mildly, went off the deep end. And sometimes a lot of people unfortunately face dangers in their own homes during COVID without escape. And I think that's what this film was sort of getting at. There's a lot of danger outside and inside, and sometimes isolating just makes everything worse. Would they have been in trouble if they went out and braved the dust? Yes, we saw what happened when her cousin tried it. It went very poorly. People died. But also people died staying in and staying completely away from it, too.
Yeah, I think that was when things started going bad, was when she stopped interacting with her community. You know, yeah. She didn't need to go out into the dust storm and you know, risk it like that, but still interacting with her community and staying up with all her friends and her family. Yeah.
Yeah. Although I did quite enjoy that one scene where all the church ladies are gathering around in the house, and they're all basically like, well, you know, this will clear up. Have faith. And the mom's basically like, okay, you can say that, but also you can sweep the floors. You're not like, why are you being so fatalist about this? We do have some control over our destinies here. We don't have to die from the dust in our homes if we just take care of our homes. You know, this isn't something the Lord can do for you. Like, yeah, there's stuff out of our control, but there is stuff in our control too. which I thought was an important message, even if she ended up taking it a little too far in the end. Just put some... Well, then again, I suppose now that I'm saying it all aloud, misplaced faith is another big theme of the movie. The kids have faith in their parents to, you know, we have faith in dad to be sending us money. We have faith in our mom to protect us. Oop, mom tried to kill us. Crap. This preacher who, let's put faith in him. He helped clear the diseases. He showed us how to extend our hay stock and, oh, crap, he tried to kill us. Oh, well, you know, let's, and him, you know, he's a man of faith who uses it to trick people and basically go against everything he would preach.
Well, also, the kids put faith in the sheriff. They're like, okay, as a last resort, the sheriff is there. We are safe. They had faith in the sheriff, and that didn't pay off either.
Yeah. And once again, the mom saying, well, you know, why are you putting your faith in God to fix problems that are in our control? And then it still went badly her way. So I think misplaced faith is another big theme of this movie. So that's about all I've got to say for real this time. You have any summarizing notes?
Well, I guess despite its flaws, I thought it was still pretty good. I think it's worth watching.
Yeah. I think, to me, the most impressive element about it was... Once I don't see very many stories in this setting. They managed to make it compellingly scary, not necessarily horrific. I don't necessarily think it's a good horror movie, but it's a very solid thriller about this dangerous environment and sort of losing control of your life that way and a slow descent into madness. It's a good psychological thriller is the term I'm looking for. I think it's very well handled in that regard. And it's a good setting. It's above average in most respects. As I said, it's pretty darn good. Definitely flawed. See, don't go in expecting a masterpiece. There's some issues with it, but I liked a lot more than I didn't.
Yeah, this is what I would call a snack movie, where the way I have everything set up, you know, if I want to put something on streaming, you know, something like this, because of the slow pace and because of the way everything's set up, you can go quickly grab a snack and still listen and still keep up with the movie and not really miss that much, because it's the overall, the building of the scenes kind of all comes together, but that it just drags a little bit. So yeah, it's worth watching, but you know, feel free to get up and grab a snack, quickly run back.
Yeah, listen. keep listening to it, but you don't need to be locked in to get what's happening.
Yeah.
Which is all right on occasion. So let's move on to question of the week. And this is an important one. Let's see. What the heck is close-up going to look like going forward? And this one's more for you. What do you think it should look like without Ryan in the co-pilot seat for every episode? He is still around. Don't, he's rest not gone peace, forever. Ryan will be back one day, probably for Vox Machina Season 3, at the very least. Maybe the next Avengers or whatever is big, but most of the time, it's just going to be me. And like I said, whatever guest stars I can wrangle up here. I do have quite a few other friends from film school who I'd be happy to call and invite onto this show as regular guest stars. I think finding people like that is more helped by the fact that we've gone to bi-weekly now, so I don't need to fill 4 episodes a month of revolving guest stars. That helps quite a bit. You did a great job today. I'd be happy to have you on more regularly, for sure. And, you know, you've only done a couple of these, but I think you did a lot better than your last time, personally, and do more, you're only going to get better. I don't think it's a skill you can backtrack on.
I hope not.
We were talking about this a little bit earlier, but in terms of what it'll end up being, just for an example here, I was saying how if I did more episodes with Justin doesn't go to a lot of theatrical movies. He's more of a what's the newest release on streaming kind of person. So if Justin came on for more review episodes, I'd probably be more compelled just by virtue of, well, you know, I could either have him on to talk about movies he hasn't seen, or I could just watch some of the things he's watching. This show might end up pivoting more towards streaming reviews and releases than theatrical, as it was with Ryan. That's just an example of how things could change with a different co-host. Anyone I bring on here is going to have their own idiosyncrasies and quirks and interests, and some of them I'll mold to, others not so much, but anyone I bring on is going to bring their own unique voice to the show, and I can only hope they mesh well with me and have interesting things to say for you all. The ideal scenario, of course, is Ryan comes back on maybe more than he's willing to right now, but I'd like to hope he'll be back more permanently at some point in the future. But until then, we're going to have to go on without him. Because, you know, it sucks to not have him here. But also, I enjoy doing this, and I don't want the show to stop. I'd like to keep it going as long as possible, even if it has to evolve into something else. Hell, maybe it could even evolve into something a little bit better. This could be a good, not to say it's better for Ryan's absence, but, you know, when he comes back, this could be a creative shot in the arm. Maybe things will change in a good way, which will leave the show even better when he does come back. Maybe. That's an ideal scenario. But, you know, things are going to change. It's not going to be the same, and Ryan will be sorely missed, especially in this transition period. What are you thinking? Any ideas on what you'd like the podcast to look like? I'd say you're the number one fan of this show. You come up with more ideas for it on the behind the scenes end than anybody. You watch pretty much every episode.
I mean, I like the idea of having revolving hosts, especially like you guys have your segments where it's like, oh, Joe explains, you know, yep. But I think having more voices on, you could stumble into somebody who comes up with another great segment. So you might even have more interesting content going on, too.
Good point. Adding more voices to the pool means more diversity in terms of ideas and things to talk about. There's a lot of things I have opinions on that I don't always necessarily think to make whole episodes about or go on tangents on air. So just to have somebody else say, hey, I want to talk about this. Oh, crap, that's a good idea. I wouldn't have thought of that. So just having extra voices might be a benefit that way. In the short term and in the long term, more collaborators never hurts. You know, in our media, in Thought Plane Media, the company Justin and I run together, we always talk about wanting to collaborate with more people anyway. And this is a good idea, a good kick in the pants to go out and actually talk to people I haven't spoken with for many years. Hey, do you want to be on the podcast? Please?
Work for Ryan.
Yeah. I don't know how many of you know this story, but that's how this podcast started in the first place. Was I was doing my film reviews on thoughtplane.ca when he commented on one of the Facebook links and said, hey, you're pretty knowledgeable about stuff. You should start a podcast. And I said, well, I mean, that sounds like something I'd like to do, but I don't want to monologue to myself for an hour. I think that'll get a little boring. And he said, well, you know, I'll do it with you. And I said, well, sure, I haven't talked to you in 5 years, but let's see how that goes. And 2.5 years later, 116 episodes in, and then he quits. I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Are you, though?
No, he's not. He's not quitting. He's just taking a bit of a backseat. So, yeah, the show is spinning off into a new era. It's scary. It's exciting. It could be anything, but stick around. And let's see where the journey takes us. It's a
spin-off like Better Call Saul.
Which I'm on record as saying is better than Breaking Bad, but, you know, Breaking Bad was pretty good too. On that note, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me on Instagram at jchurchtpm and on YouTube at ThoughtPlane Media.
You can find me on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at ThoughtPlane Media. Also, check out the Close Up with Ryan and Joe Facebook page for latest updates on the show. There's a big one coming this week, I suppose. You know, you've heard the news. You listen to the episode.
Oh.
If you listen to us in audio, check out our YouTube channel. And if you're on YouTube, find us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. We hope to see you on the next Close Up with Ryan and Joe. I have no idea what's going to be next, but hope you're there. Till next time. And big thanks to Justin for coming out.
Take care.